happening right now on the ground in terms of the recession, particularly as it pertains to people of color, but we're looking at how the problems are really based on systemic long-term issues of disparity and how we need to address those in order to have an inclusive recovery. And so we'll be speaking here shortly with Seth Wessler, who is the author and the person who did the analysis here. And we have Seth on the line.
I'm here. Thanks so much for having me on today. Thanks.
Good morning, Seth. We appreciate you being here.
Well, Seth, as you just heard on my little intro here, we kind of laid out a little bit about what you were trying to achieve. I think most folks have some idea that, you know, the recession is not hitting everyone equally. But what is it that basically you found in the process of doing this research?
Well, in this report, we find that there's really no way to think about this recession without thinking about race and racial inequality in this country. And that's true in a number of ways. The first is that in every way that this recession is hurting people in this country, it's hurting people of color harder, worse, from unemployment to underemployment to job loss to foreclosures. Communities of color across the country are facing the worst results. But what we also find is that racial inequalities, barriers to equal opportunity for people of color that existed before we were talking about a recession, actually contributed to pushing the country into this recession in the first place. That inequities in the system, unfairness in the system, are actually part of what pushed all of us into this mess we now find ourselves in.
And so, Seth, I'd like to ask the question about, we know that President Obama is just about to sign a bill related to the credit card industry, right, and kind of restructuring how credit cards are issued in this country and who qualifies. So it really supports what you're saying, which is that there are some real systemic things that were the economic norm prior to this recession, that if you look at who was penalized and who wasn't penalized, it's absolutely focused around race. And so in your report, I mean, I know you talk about housing and unemployment and underemployment. You talk about foreclosure and wealth, and then kind of the historical structure. I think banking certainly has had a lot to do with it. So it's just one example. Are there other specific examples? Because I know the listening audience, we're in Oregon. And first, I want to thank you for allowing Oregon Action to co-release this report with you. We love the opportunity always to partner with Applied Research Center. But the second thing I wanted to ask you, for our listening audience, because people will say, well, everybody's struggling right now. So why are we focused on race? Why are we bringing attention to the fact that people of color are suffering so much more severely in this economic downturn?
Yeah, that's right. You know, everybody is facing economic insecurity right now. Everybody worries about what the next week will look like, and this recession is affecting everybody's lives. But you know, you bring up housing. I think it's fair to say that we might have been in a very different situation right now in this country if we had taken seriously and thought explicitly about the targeting of communities of color long ago. You know, just 10 years ago when predatory lending sort of started to flare up in this country, by and large, it was ignored. And that was because it was happening to some people. It was happening to communities of color. And then half a decade ago, when we started to see foreclosures grow, we sort of ignored it. And it was happening, by and large, to communities of color, to Black, Latino, Asian, Native American communities in this country. And then several years ago, predatory lending, the foreclosure crisis, the credit crisis that followed, really tanked the economy. And we see that when we ignore these kinds of systemic things, the systemic things you're talking about, we put everybody at risk. We drain communities of wealth. We we abandon communities of color, and then we risk we put everybody at risk. We put the entire economy in peril. You know, I met a woman while I was traveling in the country, talking to people doing research for this report. A woman in Detroit who had had her house for 40 years in her family. Her family had put all of their wealth and accumulated assets into that house, and they took out a refinancing loan to fix the furnace, and all of a sudden the loan ballooned, and they found themselves facing foreclosure. They were evicted, moved into an apartment. They were then evicted from that apartment because that building foreclosed, and they find themselves with nowhere to go. When we drain communities of that much wealth, we really make this economy unsustainable.
Well, for those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Seth Wessler. He's the author of Race and Recession, How Inequity Rigged the Economy and How to Change the Rules, a new report by Applied Research Center. And if you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And one of the things I found interesting was your approach in this is that not only does this report contain a lot of hard data, but the report also blends in a lot of personal stories of individuals. It's sort of a weaving of both the, you know, the empirical and the anecdotal in a way that seems to me to really bring it home. What was your decision? How was that decision made to take that approach? Because you don't find it in most of these types of reports.
Yeah, you know, numbers are important, and but they only go so far. And you know, I'm a researcher, but but numbers only mean so much to me. And so the only way I think to really understand what's happening to people in this country is to talk to people and hear their stories. And these stories are really intense, and they illuminate realities in people's lives that numbers simply can't. You know, I remember talking to a woman in Arizona who was a teacher, and when the state was facing budget cuts, she was fired, and she lost her job, and her unemployment benefits ran out, and she applied for government income assistance, and she was receiving that government income assistance for a little while, and then all of a sudden, she finds her mortgage on the home she bought starts to balloon, and at the same time, her government income assistance gets cut off because she's told she's not complying with the requirements the state imposes, and so that gets cut off, and she gets behind on her mortgage. And when I talked to her, she had no income coming in at all, even though she was looking for a job, and she was about to get pushed out onto the street, out of her house. You know, these kinds of stories about the way that people face the intersections, the compounding effect of various policies, you don't learn that out of the numbers. We figure out what's happening in people's lives by talking to people, and these stories are really, they're devastating. And you know, we need to take them seriously. We need to take the effects that our policies and our lack of policies in some cases have on people's lives all over the country.
Well, we've got some phone calls coming in, so let's go to the phone line and bring in a caller who has a question for Seth Wessler. And if you want to join the conversation as well, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Dave. Hi, Joanne. Thanks
Hello.
For taking my call. What an eye-opening study, and a very important one. I had a question, though, as regards the future. And these horror stories, they're really giving me chills, and I'm sorry. But as to the future, I live in a neighborhood that years ago, prior to this current recession, was promised a kind of a redevelopment. As you know, the whole block was taken down when Emmanuel took out that area of North Portland, Joanne. But after that was promised all kinds of things. Well, now we've got a parking garage, apparently, at the hospital. But these private developments have failed utterly. And isn't that kind of an added punishment for communities of color and poor communities in the current situation? And how can that too be addressed of this, not just blight and abandonment, but promises made not at all kept?
Broken promises again.
You got it. Thanks, Joanne.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate the question. So, Seth, you want to tackle that question? Because I know you do have a lot of recommendations about how we move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think the caller raised a really important point about kinds of policies and practices and things that state and federal government are doing that we kind of think about as separate from the recession, that we actually have to think about as really part of how we get out of this recession. You know, I talked to people in communities across the country who were facing barriers to being able to live, in a sustainable economy because of things that were there beforehand, because of decisions that were made before the recession. One example that comes to mind are a whole bunch of people I talked to, dozens of people really, who had criminal convictions from as much as 25 years ago and now had no chance of really getting stable employment. We have to think about those sorts of barriers that are in the way for individuals and communities to really enter into this economy as we pull out of this recession. I mean, the question is, what kind of economy, what kind of country will we have on the other end? And will the same kinds of inequities, the same kind of unfairness that the caller mentioned, where certain communities are not finding that they're able to develop in ways that other communities are, communities of color are being neglected or not development in those communities isn't happening. What kind of economy are we going to have? And we need to take seriously and think explicitly about the way that the targeting and sometimes abandonment of communities of color in our cities and across the country is going to affect those communities and the economy as a whole.
Well, Seth, you raised an interesting question in my mind. So Congress is allocating hundreds of billions of dollars around the country in economic stimulus dollars. And so I'm curious, since you've done interviews all across the country with people, if there's any model about how we are effectively using these economic stimulus dollars to actually create a new kind of economy, because at least here in Oregon, all I'm hearing is people using those dollars to do what they've always done. So if they use those hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in economic stimulus dollars to do what they've always done, then we'll get what we've always got. So have you seen any models at all that actually you want to highlight here of people that actually are being forward thinking and how you make sure the economy works for everybody?
Yeah, you know, we kind of have a remarkable opportunity here. As you say, there is this mass of money, and it's just starting to flow into communities.
That's right.
And when I was talking to people, it hadn't hit them yet, or it wasn't. You know, they weren't feeling it, and it's just going to start now. And I think that there absolutely are important things that need to happen with these dollars. I mean, the one that comes to mind first is the creation of sustainable green jobs for community that go to people who need it most, to communities of color in this country. So when we're talking about getting people back to work, we need to be thinking about those models, which, you know, are, job creation that's good for the planet and good for people, and jobs that go to the people who are most cut out of this economy. There are examples of that across the country, and it's vitally important that we take that seriously. And at the same time, we need to pass legislation, and we need to address the existing barriers for people. We need to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. We need to legalize, pass immigrant legalization, so that immigrants are protected and are no longer exploitable as workers. We need to lift barriers to people with criminal convictions, and those are the kinds of things that, as we rebuild this economy, as we use these stimulus dollars, we need to also be removing those barriers and creating a more equitable economy.
Well, I want to follow up on that in just a moment, but we're going to go back to the phone lines because we have some callers who are waiting to give a question here. And if you want to join in the conversation, we're speaking this morning with Seth Wessler, who is the author of Race and Recession, How Inequity Rigged the Economy and How to Change the Rules. It's a new report by Applied Research Center. And if you want to join that conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Let's go to the phone line where we have Steve on the line. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Hey, great program, great topic.
Thank you.
Yeah, hey, there's a member of Congress who I think is one of the most despicable, corrupt, and he's in such a powerful position on the, as the chair of Ways and Means. Charles Rangel represents everything I despise in the Democratic Party, and he is such a such a hypocrite, and I just think our tax code is so Byzantine and ineffective, and it's really made people more cynical, if that's possible. I would like to know if you have any thoughts on Charles Rangel and his influence and the Ways and Means Committee and our tax code.
Well, we'll go to our guest and see if have you looked at it from that perspective about particular problems with the tax code, Seth, and how it may be affecting the findings of your report.
The report itself, we don't speak directly about taxes, but of course the way that we tax people in this country is totally tied to the kind of recovery we're going to have. We need to think about more progressive taxation, and this administration, I think, is actually moving in that direction more and more. Absolutely important question about taxes and progressive taxation, and I think we're moving in that direction, and there's absolutely more to do. I would say that in all of our policymaking and all of our rulemaking, our regulatory and policy rulemaking, we need to ask questions about who benefits and who's harmed. And the way that the Applied Research Center proposes that we do that is that we explicitly think about the way that policies may or may not create new racial inequality, new kinds of systemic unfairness. And what we propose is that in all of our policymaking processes, we actually implement what we call racial impact assessments. These would be modeled after environmental impact assessments that try to prevent negative environmental impacts of policies that are passed before those policies are passed. And what we would say is that, and what we argue is that we have to do that when it comes to race and racial inequity. We need to think about all of our policies and the way that those fall out. Who benefits, who suffers, and make sure that we're not deepening the existing kinds of inequalities that we show in this report. We that existed before the recession, and we're not creating new kinds of it.
And I want to remind folks here in Oregon that actually we have a bill in the legislative session, House Bill 2352, that would require a preparation of a racial and ethnic impact statement when legislation or state measures may affect the racial composition of our criminal offender population. And when the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision considers rules pertaining to parole or post-prison supervision. Seth, I want you to know that just like all across the country, Oregon's criminal justice system is totally overrepresented by people of color. We have a state legislator, Representative Chip Shields, who's actually really trying to move this issue at the state level. So we are trying to be very proactive about making sure that we're not exacerbating the problem, especially in this economic environment that we're in.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phone lines because I think we have some more callers. And again, if you want to join the conversation we're having with Seth Wessler of Applied Research Center about race and the recession, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And we have another Steve on the line. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Few comments. Number one, I definitely think that you guys are doing a good job as far as bringing up some issues in your work. I agree with you that the fact that I think some of the poor parts of the country are definitely hit hard, just in the fact that the unemployment opportunities are lacking. But also, I gotta comment on the fact that, you know, other people who don't live in the poor parts of town are awfully getting impacted as well, as far as, you know, life savings, 401k savings getting cut in, you know, 60%, 70%. For example, you could have someone that worked at Intel and has $500,000 in retirement 2 years ago. Now it's worth $130,000, you know,
right.
And then they're going to retire in 6 months.
Right.
So I think that was pretty impactful comparatively to someone who has no retirement savings and then still just can't find a job. It's completely different, but very, very similar in the same way.
Well, in fact,
and my other comment is, I don't think you can really draw a parallel between environmental impacts and race. I think that's a ridiculous comparison. And if you're going to put some money into something, why don't you put money into education? I mean, the only thing that's going to really raise people up in this world is not only, you know, it's not green jobs. You keep saying green jobs. Well, give me an example, because I tell you what, people in the ghetto and poor people aren't going to be building hydro turbines or anything like that.
Well, sure, Steve, hold on a second, Steve. Steve, hold on a second. Yeah, there's actually a lot of good examples. It's just they don't happen to be happening here in Oregon. But
that's
for example, in Richmond, California,
right. There's
a program going on, and I can't recall the name of it, but what they do is they take youth of color, and they put them in what are kind of pre-apprentice jobs. And what they're doing is they're solarizing homes. It's a relatively entry-level type of technology into green tech, something that you don't need an advanced degree to do, but you'd start building up skills that transfer to moving up in that industry. These kids are going out and doing that sort of thing. So there are lots of...
That's my example as far as education goes. Those people are going to have to get certified just like any other carpenter or electrician.
Well, this program is actually in conjunction with the unions and with the city of Richmond, and it puts into place an opportunity for them to work their way into that process. But the important part is creating a gateway for them to become involved. Otherwise, we're just back to where we were. So that's just...
I agree with you. I think that's part of the education. I don't think that's, you know, I think, you know, we're kind of, we mislead the public. And when people keep saying green jobs, well, when in fact, it's about education.
Yeah.
But
know,
Steve,
these young kids are becoming educated as far as, oh, now I can install something. Now I have a technical skill. Now I understand how maybe I can branch off and start my own business.
But Steve,
rather than here's some money.
Hello, Steve.
Yeah.
Are you, Steve?
I think
one point that you're missing. I mean, it's not either or. You may have heard Dave, when he started the program, talk about the front page of the Oregonian. There's no question that people across the economic spectrum are suffering today, right? And whether or not they've had a great education with a six-figure income or whether they've always worked minimum wage jobs, we can agree that across the board people are suffering. I'm not done, Steve. And
okay.
So the point isn't either or. The point is, how do you create an economy that's going to work for all of us? We can't just rebuild an economy that works for the quote-unquote middle class at the expense of low-wage, low-skill workers.
No, I agree. But at the same time, you can't, like with the PDC, you can't just throw money at people who have, you know, no sense of business acumen and just give them a couple hundred K and say, here you go, start a business, good luck, and at this percentage return.
Well, there are a lot of businesses on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard right now that have received millions of dollars from PDC. And they are empty. And PDC continues to give them money. They didn't give those to poor people. They didn't give it to people of color. They didn't give it to people without education. And so it's, again, it's not an either or. It's how do we like step back from this economic crisis and make sure that what we're putting in place with these investment of federal dollars that you and my great grandchildren will be paying back. How do we make sure that we're creating an economy where across the economic gambit, everybody's going to have an opportunity to benefit?
I don't know. That's a tough question. I mean, if you, I think that's too big for the government. I mean, they can't even run a car company, let alone, you know.
Well, that's why we...
The car companies can't run the car company. Right. So that's why the government stepped in. Well, Steve, look, we're going to have to move on because we've got some other questions for our guest here. But thanks a lot for raising those issues.
But appreciate your call. Have a great day.
Well, Seth, I...
Do you want to... Seth.
We've kind of sidetracked you there. But obviously, he laid out a lot of questions and concerns. But, you know, I think... I think many Americans have that same concern about, what do these new ideas mean?
And let's just educate everybody.
Yeah.
Because education will fix it all. Yeah. And I've been hearing that for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think there's a real, it's easy to think that, as you said, it is an either or thing, but it's really not. You know, I grew up in Maine. Everybody I know in my home state of Maine who's unemployed right now are white people. You know, it's easy to, and in fact, everybody is affected by this recession. He's also right about the fact that people's 401ks are being drained. And the point we make is that it is not an either or situation. And as long as we think about it that way, everybody is in peril. And this recession makes that so clear. You know, when we think about, we've had a country that has had incredible growth, and most people, most everybody have failed to benefit from that growth. I mean, that is the economy we've had, and the question is, what kind of economy do we want to have when we are on the other end of this? We want an economy that has growth and also equality, and in this country, you know, we can't think about equality without also thinking about race and barriers to particular communities that stand in the way of that equitable economy.
One of the data points that you point out in your report is that according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 8 of the 10 occupations projected to generate the most jobs by 2016 are low-wage jobs in the service sector. And so that, to me, that's like a warning sign. Danger, danger. You know, we're headed down a path that's going to continue to create poverty, the haves and have-nots. If that's the direction we're headed in, I think that sends off all kind of concerns.
That's right. You know, more and more people are going to be relegated to those positions that do not pay them enough to support their families. I met a woman on my travels who worked two jobs to try to support her kids. She's an immigrant, an undocumented immigrant who's trying to support her family, and she lost those jobs, and she's then relegated to other service sector jobs that simply don't pay enough for her to support her family. But you know, those are, as you said, and as we find in the report, these are the kinds of jobs that are going to be expanding. We're going to have more and more of those kinds of low-paying jobs, and unless we protect all workers, unless that woman I just talked about, it can't be exploited, is, you know, it can't be made to work making sub-minimum wages. Everybody who finds themselves in these kinds of positions is going to be, you know, at risk and really unable to support their families to live, you know, sustainable lives. And so, as we recover from this recession, we need to think about what kind of jobs we're creating. You know, are these going to support people and families and communities and people's needs?
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking this morning with Seth Wessler. He's the author of Race and Recession, How Inequity Rigged the Economy and How to Change the Rules, a new report by Applied Research Center. And if you want to join in that conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And before we go back to Seth, we're going to just remind you of why you need to keep that dial set at 90.7 FM this morning, because coming up on KBOO at 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. The topic, Guantanamo terrorists won't get your mama. At 9:30, Jenka Sonderberg interviews Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, who was crushed by an Israeli bulldozer while trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian doctor's home. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, labor reporter David Bacon discusses Penny Pritzker's leadership in the movement against the Employees' Free Choice Act. And Catherine Austin Fitz returns with the Community Business segment. At 11 on Between the Covers, Northwest writer Susan Wingate discusses her book, Bobby's Diner, a story of women against crime and corruption in a tiny town. And at 11:30, the guests are Russell Lee Sharman and Cheryl Harris Sharman, authors of Night Shift NYC, the stories of New York City night shift workers. And while all that and more coming up on KBOO. And while we're still on the announcement section, I just want to remind folks that there's an event coming up this Saturday. On Saturday, May 23rd at 7 p.m., dissidents will be hosting Liberating Dissent 2 Against State Repression at Liberty Hall. This event will raise funds for Green Scare Prisoners and Rose City Cop Watch. Featured speakers are Lauren Reagan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center and Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. Music provided by Resist, Adelaide at Us, Silent Majority, and Coffin Ship. For more information, you can contact destroycreate@gmail.com. Again, that's going to be at 7 p.m. at Liberty Hall this Saturday. It's a $6 to $100 sliding scale. That's quite a slide there, but it's to benefit those organizations. So let's go on back to our discussion here. I think we're going to hold off on the phone calls for just a moment because Richard is bent over looking very serious about something. So let's go back to Seth.
You know, Seth, I had a question for you. And so I'm amazed at how many people do not still know the history of housing discrimination in the country. And I noticed that your report does an excellent job of really giving people in very plain language kind of what some of the milestones have been around housing discrimination. And of course, leading up to the 2007 subprime loan crisis. One of the things that I find most intriguing is when people talk about the New Deal and how the New Deal made it possible for people to own homes, most folks don't realize that federal policy only made it possible for some people to be able to purchase homes. Would you like to elaborate on that point a little bit, please?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is a real clear example of what happens when we create policies that don't include everybody. You know, after the New Deal or during the New Deal, there was a real effort to make housing affordable for the first time to broad categories of people. Before the New Deal, poor people, most working people couldn't afford homes. There were huge down payments, and it was just absolutely unaffordable. And the New Deal made it possible for people to buy homes in putting in place longer term mortgages and lower down payments, and all of a sudden large categories of people could own homes. But as a result of racialized policies that excluded people of color from owning homes, excluded areas where people of color lived from achieving home ownership, communities of color just weren't able to buy homes and weren't able to develop the same kind of wealth that white communities were able to. And so, you know, this is practices of redlining where literally communities where maps were drawn by the federal government and communities where people of color lived were marked as red to signify high risk. They were denied loans. And for years, that was the case. And then, you know, that history continued. And when the GI Bill was passed and thousands of veterans returned and were given low-cost loans to achieve home ownership. Once again, restrictive codes or called covenants, restrictive racial covenants, which were private agreements that disallowed people of color from access to equity home equity loans. Communities of color were once again impossible for them to buy homes, and so for years, communities of color were excluded from that kind of wealth-building opportunity. And the place we find ourselves in now with this subprime crisis can actually be separated from that, because as a result of this long history of depriving these communities of equitable, fair lending practices, when redlining and restrictive covenants were finally outlawed, and communities of color started to be swarmed with new kinds of lenders. And then we find ourselves at the turn of the century in 1999, financial sectors widely deregulated, and new kinds of arrangements happen between Wall Street and lenders, and communities of color who didn't have access to fair lending products because of that long history I just described, all of a sudden those communities get filled with predatory high cost lenders, and Black, Latino, American, Indian, Asian communities have access to these kinds of loans, and so really the crisis we're seeing now is built upon a long history of explicit racial discrimination, but what we're now seeing are policies or practices or the lack of regulation that fail to address the residue of that history.
Okay, Seth. Well, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I just wanted to say that we are talking with Seth Wessler of Applied Research Center about his new report on race and recession. We wanted to go back to the phone lines because we have some callers waiting, and if you other listeners want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Let's go to our next caller. We have another Jeff. We seem to have a shortage of names this morning.
That's right. Jeff and Steve are the only callers.
Or multiple personalities. We don't know what it is. Okay, Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Housing is a very important thing. I don't believe that housing should take up more than one quarter of your take-home pay. But somehow the big market players have set it up to where we have this market economy and the price of housing keeps going up, while at the same time the pay of jobs doesn't always go up. There's a lot of part-time jobs being created, and I think we just need a revolution of the mind. I think we need to just understand that not everybody is equipped to go out and compete in the global economy. Some people just want to live here and live their life, and they just want the basics, and we need to be able to disconnect from this global economy, because the fact is that global population growth can consume up everything. It can consume up all of the livability, all of the resources, and it will drastically divide peoples along income lines, with the rich getting richer and more insecure. By the way, they seem to have to spend a lot of their money on security systems, cameras, extra police. It doesn't appear that they're actually enjoying the extra accrued wealth that they're taking in. And meanwhile, citizens who are trying to just make it and get by have rapidly rising costs and flat or real lower wages. So we need to realize that the only way out of this mess is zero population growth, because it's the only thing that's going to stabilize prices and income and let us understand that we need to just relate across to each citizen. Each citizen needs, you know, a minimum level of livability guarantee, something like perhaps was done in Japan or Germany after World War II, where those societies were able to rise up again. Part of the important re-stabilization of those societies was they did choose zero population growth, and it made their economic recovery possible. So,
okay, Jeff. Well, thanks for those comments, and we need to move on here, but thank you for that observation. Seth, I wanted to actually... because we are starting to get towards the latter half of the hour here, I wanted to go back to some of the key recommendations you've put in here, and the report breaks it down kind of into an overarching policy framework, which talks about racial equity impact assessments, which we've already talked a little bit about. Then you have some intermediate actions to alleviate the state of emergency, and then also policies needed within the next year. And I wanted to jump to the policies within the next year. You have a couple of things here, the Employee Free Choice Act and the Community Reinvestment Act modernization. And first of all, the Employee Free Choice Act, that's become quite the hot subject right now. There's quite a bit of controversy over that act. Why don't you explain to our listeners what the Employee Free Choice Act is, and how does that fit into this picture of breaking down the structural barriers that create disparity?
Yeah, well, really important, and actually in some ways in response to the last caller. The Employee Free Choice Act would make it possible for people to unionize without fear of employer retaliation or employer intimidation, something that people face all the time now when in their workplaces. And the point is that unless workers are protected and unless workers are able to demand higher wages and more fair workplaces, we're going to have an economy where people are working and can't support their families. The way that we're going to address the fact that there's huge growth and then workers are not benefiting from any of that is making sure that workers are getting paid for the work that they do. And that over the last decades, as we've seen jobs deunionized at record rates, wages have also fallen. And so if we're going to recover in a way that really helps everybody, that's a really important piece of the picture.
So, Seth, I'm curious, as you've been doing interviews around the country, are you finding that labor unions are being as inclusive as they need to be to include people of color, women, and are they represented at every level in those decision-making bodies? Because that's my concern. My concern is if we spread a system that's unequal now, that we would just exacerbate an unequal system. And so Dave and I have had this conversation a few times on the air about who really benefits from the Employee Free Choice Act and how do we make sure that the folks that we've been talking about today, those on the downside of this economy, really are going to benefit.
Well, that's a really, really important question. And I think that what's so necessary to keep in mind is that it's important that employees can unionize and that all workers are able to organize themselves, whether it's in a union or through workers' centers or other workers' organizations. Absolutely vitally important. And at the same time, we need to think about other policies and other practices that exclude people of color from entering into employment, from equitable job opportunities in the first place. So that's why we talk about the need for the creation of, as we said before, green and sustainable jobs that really do train people to maintain those positions. We need to talk about immigrant legalization so that we don't maintain whole categories of people, immigrant workers who are exploitable, can be paid less than a minimum wage, as a result, all workers, really suffer. And we need to remove, barriers, other barriers. For example, we need to expunge criminal records of people with, long past criminal convictions. So we need to do this at multiple levels, and to make sure that as people go back to work, as we sort of move out of this recession, that those barriers and those policies that create a really inequitable economy, that create inequality, those barriers to people of color are removed. These are not separate discussions.
And then the two other big pieces that you propose should happen this year is, of course, the comprehensive universal health care and the Community Reinvestment Act being modernized.
Yeah, I talk to, people in lots of places in this country where not having health care was just devastating, and people of color are much less likely to have health insurance, be it employer-based health insurance or government health insurance or private health insurance, and people are suffering really horrible costs. You know, family members dying, young kids, parents dying, people being forced to continue working in debilitating pain when they don't have health care. You know, this is, we're not creating a healthy country when that is the case. And then you mentioned the Community Reinvestment Act. The Community Reinvestment Act passed in the 70s to deal with issues of redlining and housing discrimination. As this country has deregulated the financial sector and the mortgage lending sector, more and more loan lending practices have fallen outside of that Community Reinvestment Act, which was supposed to protect communities from predatory and discriminatory lending. You know, most of the vast majority of the subprime loans that have been sold over the last decade were not covered by the Community Reinvestment Act. The lenders were not covered by the Community Reinvestment Act. And so what we need to do is create modernize that act to create regulatory frameworks that actually deal with the new financial world that we live in. You know, we've deregulated to the point where people aren't protected anymore, and the people who are most impacted, the people who feel the worst effects, are those who are already vulnerable. So for that reason, we need to really bring this up to date.
We're going to go back to the phone lines because we have a caller or two waiting to join in the conversation. So let's go in, and if you want to join us in the 10 minutes that's left, we're talking with Seth Wessler at Applied Research Center. You can give us a call at 503-231-8187. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling to kind of reiterate something a previous caller said about a revolutionary shift in our thinking. And the first point I wanted to make is I do find sustainable solutions that are certainly happening. So that's the first point, is that it's great to see little pockets of solutions that are actually being integrated, and that's a good thing. But there are answers and solutions that I see that, you know, ideas that we're ready for. It's just how do we get it, you know, out there so we can make get the stagnant policies moving again, like up to date, it seems to me. Well, here's the thing I'd like to find out, whether or not the guest speaker could give me some feedback on. It's kind of a idea directly related to a solution to the stimulus package. My idea was that what we did was we put all the money at the top instead of at the bottom. My idea was, if we were to have a federal minimum wage across the board, so say $7 an hour federal for all states, and then all states put their minimum wage on top of that, so we have an $8 minimum wage on the state and then a $7, and we have suddenly a $15 minimum wage across the country. Now, all that money is going to go directly back into the economy. It would be absorbed 100%, because those people who are working the minimum wage jobs are putting their money all back into their rent, their bills, their payments, and that would be absorbed all the way up to the top, it seems to me.
Okay, well, let's see what Seth thinks about that. Seth, do you have a comment on that idea?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, we're seeing in places, some places in this country, the rise of living wage ordinances that take seriously the need for people to be able to, so that when people work, they get paid enough to actually live, which is a pretty basic idea. And I think the caller is right on when thinking about making sure that that work pays. The other thing I would add to that is that, and there's people pushing this across the country. I'd mentioned the Restaurant Opportunity Center's been pushing this. We actually also need to make sure that when the minimum wage rises, there's a cost of living adjustment attached to it, and also that tipped workers, that we return tip workers' minimum wage to 60% of the full minimum wage, because right now tip workers have a minimum wage of $2.13, and that's just about nothing when people often aren't taking home enough tips. So minimum wage legislation is really important. We need to raise the minimum wage. We need to make sure that there's a cost of living adjustment so that as the cost of living increases, so does the minimum wage. And then we need to think about building the real cost of living and what wages need to be. So the caller raises an important point, and that's one of our recommendations, that we raise the minimum wage to the cost of living.
Right. We should add that in. We should. Thank you, John.
I was going to ask if there's any chance I can make one more quick comment. I wanted to thank you for the answer, but there's one last thing.
Okay, make it quick because we're running out of time.
30 seconds
sure.
to us.
This is in regards to the universal health care. I'm a veteran. I get veterans benefits. It's my saving grace, and I collect Social Security. And the first thing I do of the month is I use that to pay off all my bills, and then whatever's left I live on. Well, if that concept were taken to universal health care, we have the money. We just, the very first thing we do is we put the money where it needs to be, and then what's left is what we distribute it. Is that at all possible just to, okay, we can do the health care.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to take that one up. As
Thank
we
you.
Move forward, thank you so much
Thanks,
for
John.
Your call. I wanted to let Seth know that in Oregon, our governor is proposing 27,000 temporary jobs of $10 or less for the summer months, at the same time that we are getting hundreds of billions of dollars and distributed resources. So these aren't monies that we have to actually compete for. This is money that's actually going to come into our state to recreate an economy that works for the rest of us. I see a disconnect between creating 27,000 temporary summer jobs that we're using unemployment dollars to fund and really thinking through how do you create an economy that works for the rest of us. In response to the callers, if we fix health care, which we're working on at the state level and at the national level, that will not be the second largest expense of most individuals and businesses in this country. And so we've got to fix that this year as well.
You have left out, of course, that governor's proposal would be giving people that important brush-cutting skills that will get them competitive
in
the marketplace.
Wage. Right.
It will help them all winter, right?
Yeah,
that's
right. That's right. Yeah,
it will help them heat their houses. And
we'll be poor, but our yards will be tidy.
Right.
And
you know,
so
I think they're getting half of the picture, right? People need to get back to work. That's absolutely true, and that's what this. It seems that the governor is thinking about. People need to be working, and
right.
we do need to get people back into jobs because people need to be working to support their families,
that's
and
right.
because for this economy to work, we need people in jobs. But as you say, you know, and as we find in this report. If we're going to do that, we need to make sure those jobs are sustainable and that they are paying people enough to support their families. As long as we have a work that leaves people in situations where they can't pay for health care because there isn't any health care and they can't afford food and people are worried about literally putting food on the table for their kids, I mean, that is not the economy that I think most of us want. And so as these dollars get put into play, we need to be thinking about that question.
Well, as we're just wrapping up here with a few minutes, but in looking at, you know, what you found and what Applied Research Center is recommending, how far off course is Congress and the administration? How much do we need to be pushing them? Are they starting to get the idea, or are they clueless, or are somewhere in between?
Here's what I'd say, and I'd say for some of these answers, go check out arc.org/recession, and also racewire.org, one word, racewire.org. A lot of these questions are tackled. One of the exciting things about this moment is that a lot of these questions are on the table. Healthcare is on the table. Immigration reform is on the table. There's new discussions happening about the criminal justice system and about reentry and people returning to their communities. So the discussions are happening, and that's important. But the point is, how are all these policies going to look? And we don't know. And it's on us to put the pressure on right now to make sure that when healthcare reform happens, because it will happen, it's inclusive, that everybody has access to health care, to make sure that that immigration reform happens in such a way that actually benefits communities. These are the important questions right now. The most important policies of of the time are on the table right now, and we all have an opportunity to get into this discussion. We have to. There's potential.
Well, Seth, I want to thank you for taking the time this morning to talk with us about this report. It's a very important piece of analysis and recommendations that you and the Applied Research Center has put together, and I strongly urge people to go to arc.org/recession, and they can pull up the report and read it themselves, the full report. It's about 55 pages of a lot of good data in there and a lot of good information that you need to be able to have a to engage in public discourse on this. But we want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, and I want you to know that not only are we taking this report to the state legislature today, we're going to be taking it and having a conversation with our congressional members up at the Hill next month. So thank you for your hard work, and it's been a pleasure. I'm Joanne Bowman.
Whoa, she's jumping off the ship right away here. I was going to remind folks, of course, that they can go to kboo.fm/voicesfromtheedge and get the podcast of this interview. And also to let folks know that we next week will be talking, we promise, truly promise, we will be talking with Attorney General John Kroger. Those of you who tuned in last week waiting to hear our conversation with him may have been a little disappointed because, unfortunately, he got called away on other business. But we will have him back next week to talk about his proposal to beef up the or recreate the civil rights unit in the Attorney General's office. And with that, I'm Dave Mazza.
And I'm Joanne Bowman.
And you've been listening to Voices from the Edge. You have a good morning now.
Have a great day.